discussion. Keep the schedule as best we can. Thank you all for staying. I think you'll find this an interesting panel. For those of us in private practice, this is not an abstract discussion. It's a very concrete discussion. Their clients are calling every day with denial of service issues or theft issues. It's not an area in which statistics are particularly relevant but or definitive, but here are some anyway. In 2010, the industries most frequently compromised were hospitality, that was 40% of the breaches, retail 25%, financial services 22%. Most of the actual bits of lost data relate to financial services, that's just where the money is. So far this year, as according to one semi-reliable source, as of June 21, there were 213 breaches reported, private companies, over 11.7 million records exposed. That doesn't include the more than 100 million Sony records that are still being investigated. The average total cost of a data breach per year per company was more than $7.2 million. A lot of that is attributed to lost business, but by the time you hire the consultants and the specialists and the lawyers and you mail out thousands of letters, you get to 7.2 pretty easily. Jeremy, I don't know if you're still here, but the tort lawyers are already in this game. Many of us are defending class actions in this area. One in five companies faced their first data breach in 2010. It's kind of been alluded to earlier, but one can really envision a cyber 9/11, which would be something like a coordinated attack on the West financial information systems, making the records unreliable and causing widespread panic and instability. I'm delighted to introduce our panelists to help us think about this. I'll do it briefly from the far end of the table down. Orrin Kerr teaches criminal law, criminal procedure, and computer crime law. A former law clerk for Justice Kennedy, and served for 3 years as a trial attorney in the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property section of the Justice Department. Mark Rotenberg is Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown Law School and has testified before Congress on many issues and before the 9/11 Commission, served on many national and international advisory panels. He's the former chair of the Public Interest Registry, which manages the .org domain. He's done many other things. He's also the 2007 Washington, D.C. chess champion. Those of you who are expecting Gus Caldabella, his friends and fans, we are missing him. Gus is caught in the middle of a breaking client situation, but if you're ever going to withdraw from a panel, you do it with style, the way Gus does. He called and said, "I can't do it, but how would you like Raytheon's cyber guy?" In that connection, we're lucky enough to have John Smith, who is Raytheon's cyber lawyer. Before that, he was the White House's cyber lawyer. He was associate counsel to the president and legal advisor to the White House Homeland Security Council. Served for a decade as a reservist in the U.S. Army. Thank you for your service. And as a lay leader in his church congregation. Michael Vadis was truly present at the creation. He's now a partner at Steptoe & Johnson, focusing on this area. He was the founding director of the National Infrastructure Protection Center at the FBI, which was the first government organization to think about and defend against and identify cyber attacks. Before that, he was Associate Deputy Attorney General for National Security Matters, and he led the development of the nation's first policies regarding cybersecurity and critical infrastructure protection. We're going to have sort of a hybrid format, not quite the free-flowing discussion that Paul moderated. I'm not as facile as Paul, but we do have questions. Question to each panelist. It'll start perhaps 10 minutes of discussion, then perhaps 3 minutes of commentary by a sort of a principal alternative commentator, and then a free flow. Four of those, hopefully we'll get through it in a time that will allow 10, 15 minutes for questions. So the first question I have is to John Smith, and it's probably the obvious one. John, what cybersecurity challenges are faced by a company like Raytheon, and what, if anything, can the government do to help?
Yeah. Good question, and I'm grateful to be with you today and to be with this panel. You would have had an excellent presentation from Gus Coldabella, but I'm glad to join this group. So let me talk about a couple of things about the environment generally that provide a challenge for private companies like Raytheon of a legal nature. I'll go quickly through the first aspect because there's some overlap with the excellent presentations we heard in this morning's panel and from Stuart's presentation as well. And then we'll focus on two specific challenges within that environment and what the federal government might be able to do, since that's part of our focus today, or not do, or stop doing in order to help companies address that threat. As was mentioned in the earlier sessions, there does need to be a fair degree of humility by lawyers. Lawyers are not going to solve this problem. We can help address it, work with those who have solutions and help them, stay within lanes. But we need to be humble about the role that lawyers are going to have here. In cyberspace, we have encountered a number of the old goals that bad guys often have, right? Stealing, spying, disabling, manipulating, and destroying. Although, of course, here we're talking about information in the cyber domain. And for the private sector, particularly of relevance of those verbs are stealing, spying, and disabling. On stealing, what are companies concerned about being stolen? Obvious answer there is intellectual property and proprietary information. This is the third panel that many of you have, or third session that many of you sat through, so and it's after lunch. So I will try to vary things a little bit by reading something recent from outside the exact cyber context, but I think you'll get the analogy. This is from the Wall Street Journal. Just 2 weeks ago. The world's first pirate stock exchange was established in 2009 in Hardahrir in Mogadishu, some 250 miles northeast of Mogadishu, Somalia. Open 24 hours a day, the exchange allows investors to profit from ransoms collected on the high seas, which can approach $10 million for successful attacks against Western commercial vessels. While there are no credible statistics available, reports from various news sources suggest that over 70 entities are listed on the Hardahrir exchange. When a pirate operation is successful, it pays investors a share of the profits. According to a former pirate who spoke to Reuters, quote, the shares are open to all and everybody can take part, whether personally at sea or on land, by providing cash, weapons, or useful materials. We have made piracy a community activity. End quote. Think about that in the context of international intellectual property. And of course, in this United States, probably in this building, people expend an enormous amount of effort to protect intellectual property of U.S. companies, U.S. individuals, and all their multinational companies. And yet, cyberspace opens up an opportunity where it's not hard to imagine this piracy analogy elsewhere in the world. Certainly, China and other parts of the United States and other parts of the world have shown that their lack of regard for the intellectual property rules that we in the West live by. Second point on intellectual property. We've talked about some historical analogies. Think about the Soviet Union. There's a fascinating book called The Sword and the Shield about the story of the Soviet intelligence service. Came out right at the time communism was collapsing. The writing of it was enabled by the defection of the KGB's archivist, who had brought with him thousands of documents when he defected to the West. And the conclusion of the book is that while the Soviet Union had a very difficult time, had considerable difficulty in understanding us as a country and what motivated us and strategically, they made some poor judgments about what our intentions were because they couldn't quite get inside the American mindset. But something they took us to the cleaners on was science and technology. I think that's another very important historical analogy that we consider as private companies worry about how competitors and competing nation states might seek to use their intelligence capabilities in cyberspace. It's not when we read about the persistence of and capability of Chinese hackers, it's not difficult to imagine that there may be an effort underway to build a library of the world's best intellectual property, just like you and I think about Google, right? If we want to know something that we think is out there, we do a search on Google. We know it's an open public library, in a sense, of all sorts of information. Wouldn't it be great to have a private library with the world's best intellectual property all in one place at your fingertips if you needed it? So that's probably enough about stealing, spying, and disabling. There was also already some references about Anonymous and other hackers. Of course, though the bad guys have these same old bad goals, there's new possibilities that cyberspace provides for them, and that new space challenges our traditional legal framework. We've already talked about that in the previous sessions, the uncertainty of the law in this area and certain aspects of the nature of cyberspace, the way in which attribution is difficult, the way that remote access enables people, bad guys from all over the world, to come into companies and take out their good stuff. I'll mention one more that was alluded to, and that is the lack of governance, both with the authority of law, who's authorized to make rules in cyberspace, the substance of law, what are the rules that apply in a given situation that a company might be facing, and the power of law, who can enforce those rules. So moving to the first specific legal challenge, there was mention in the first panel about securing critical infrastructure. If we look not just to critical infrastructure, but any company that might want to protect itself, one key aspect of cybersecurity is to secure the network. You've got to monitor the traffic on those networks, and that would include internal traffic as well. Who creates internal traffic in companies? Employees. They have legal rights. They have privacy interests. We're familiar with WikiLeaks. Of course, that was a government context, but you get the idea. Insiders can present a real threat to companies, sometimes unwittingly by opening attachments and clicking on links, and sometimes maliciously, particularly in a downturning economy where an employee knows they're going to be let go and wants to stick it to the company on the way out or feather their nest for their next job. And even in this situation where you're talking about a U.S. company monitoring its own U.S. employees on U.S.-based and located equipment, there is still some legal uncertainty that remains about the extent to which companies may do that, even if they have the consent, appropriate consents that were discussed in the previous panel. And that's because of the difference, this being the Federalist Society, between federal and state law. The federal law, that statute that applies, the Electronic Communications and Privacy Act, requires only one party consent, right? And if you're an employee, you probably come to, when you fire up your computer, you click on a consent banner. It says, I consent to be monitored if, you know, as I work on my computer on this system. But state laws are different. There's at least a dozen states that require all party consent, at least in the statutes that were passed when before the internet was even conceived of. The context for many of these statutes when they were first promulgated was monitoring of telephone conversations, right? To what extent does that apply to the internet? So what can the United States government do about this particular threat, or this particular obstacle, I should say, that companies face, this legal uncertainty in trying to at least monitor their own people working on their own networks of the company? One thing that would be helpful would be express federal preemption of state privacy laws, at least as far as they affect electronic communications that affect interstate commerce. This is the Federal Society, so I knew you'd want to know under what constitutional basis Congress could pass such a law. I would say interstate commerce. Though the White House proposal, the administration's proposal that Stuart just described doesn't have a provision like this, it's at least heading in that direction in the area of data breaches, right? Federal standard for data breaches. If we could do that for state privacy laws affecting electronic communications monitoring, that would remove a considerable degree of legal uncertainty. How we're doing on time?
Over.
Okay. Well, I'll leave the rest for questions. Thanks.
Does anyone invite comments from any of the panels? So I'd like to start with Oren.
Sure. The question of the role of federal versus state law in the surveillance laws is a really tricky one, and one that tends to not get a lot of attention because the federal government doesn't really care. Federal investigators are not bound by state surveillance laws, so if the federal investigators end up in a state that is governed by where private actors have to follow the state laws, the federal investigators just, it does not affect them. Under the Supremacy Clause, they're only regulated by the federal law. So this is one of those issues where it's really incumbent on the regulated parties and those corporations primarily to push this. And I think that my sense is that probably the federal government wouldn't really care one way or the other, wouldn't oppose such a change. It does strike me as a good idea in part because all party consent statutes, I think, are just a terrible idea, especially in a world of internet communications where it's understood that one side is able to and likely will or can record communications. And also those of you that have followed the issue of, can you record a police officer in a public encounter? It's the all-party consent statutes that raise what to me is the troubling prospect that it's illegal to record a police officer as the officer is harassing you or arresting you or doing something that you want to record. So the cops can record it, but you can't, being the gist of it. So I think the all-party consent statutes that may have made some sense in a telephone era really just don't make any sense anymore given the changes in the technology. So I don't know if it's a question of preemption. I guess that's really the way of solving the problem uniformly. But I do think that's a real problem.
Anyone else?
Just to add one note to exemplify the problem this causes, under an all-party consent law, you would arguably need to get consent not just from somebody who is at his computer surfing the web. You'd also have to get the consent of the website that he's surfing on the basis that it's a party to that communication, even if it's just a machine.
This is a question to Michael. There are a lot of overlapping issues, a lot of cyber threats, and just as a very crude way of putting shape on two panels, we divided the panel names into national security and economic security. And I'm going to ask you, Michael, whether that's really a meaningful distinction. If not, why not? And then as a practical application of it, ask you to comment on the proposal for the Department of Homeland Security's review of businesses' security plans.
Sure. Well, I think it's a meaningful distinction in the sense that when you're talking about national security issues in cyberspace, you've got to talk about the laws of war and legal and policy issues that arise from the use of cyber attack tools offensively. It also makes sense because on the national security side, you're generally talking about a different set of threats. You're talking about nation states and terrorist groups largely. Whereas on the economic security side, you're largely talking about criminals and maybe so-called hacktivists who have a beef against certain segments of industry. On the other hand, though, the areas overlap to such an extent that it's not meaningful to separate them because you're often talking about the same targets. Raytheon, for example, could be a target of a national security threat that wants to get defense secrets. Or it could be targeted by criminals and hacktivists as well. And when you're under attack, if you're a company or a government agency or any other target, when you're being attacked, at least in the early days, you don't know who's attacking you. So when you're in that position, you don't care whether it's an economic threat or a national security threat. You're under attack. You want it to stop. And you want to figure out who did it. So your response, at least initially, is going to be the same. On the same token, the government's response is largely going to be the same by necessity because it doesn't know if it's dealing with two teenagers in California or a hostile foreign government, which was the case in one of the early attacks, in fact, in the weeks that I started in this field at the FBI in 1998. The Defense Department thought it was under attack from Iraq because we were preparing to launch airstrikes against Iraq for not letting in UN weapons inspectors. And after several days of great concern and mobilization within the government, the briefing of the president that we were under attack by Iraq turned out to be indeed two teenagers in California. So it just exemplifies that in the early days, you don't know whether it's a national security event or an economic security event. So as a result of that, I think that overlap, the solutions that we come up with have to address both problems simultaneously. Even if the solutions may differ somewhat, the central set of solutions, I think, have to deal with both sets of issues. Until now, when it's come to government regulation, the government is really just focused on the economic side. When you think about the few regulations that do exist in the area, at the federal level, you're talking about HIPAA, which protects personal health data. You're talking about the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, which protects personal health information. And you're generally talking about FTC enforcement actions under the FTC's very general authority to police unfair and deceptive practices. And the FTC has interpreted that mandate broadly to give them the authority to sanction companies that the FTC feels have inadequate security. But all of these things are addressed at the failure of companies adequately to protect personal information. They don't speak at all to companies' failure to protect their systems from devastating attacks that could bring those systems down completely, or by bringing those systems down could bring down the delivery of electric power to a region or telecommunications or financial services to a city or to a whole country. No regulations really speak to that at all. So when it comes to the administration's proposal, Stewart, he didn't use this term today, but he was quoted while he was actually high in the Himalayas. He was quoted as calling the administration's proposal weak tea. And I actually don't disagree with that assessment, but I would note that it is at least tea, and it is at least caffeinated tea in the sense that it is really the first effort come out of any of the last three administrations that tries to begin to take on this problem of protecting our critical infrastructures from not just the ankle biter, level attacks, but also national attacks, by engaging the DHS in this somewhat convoluted process of reviewing companies, at least critical infrastructure companies, cybersecurity plans. And so I think that's a good thing, but it is not enough at this point. There are no real sanction or penalties behind it that DHS can impose. And so it's at least, I think, a good start. It's better than where we've been. In the past, you know, any effort to even think about regulation in this area was adamantly opposed by almost everyone. Conservatives opposed it because it was another instance of government regulation of business, which would, you know, the fear was that would have negative economic consequences and was just philosophically objectionable. Liberals opposed it because they feared that this would be a way of infringing on people's privacy and free speech. I remember when Janet Reno, in a Justice Department report in the late 90s, there was a sentence in this report that said, anonymity is a thorny issue. A thorny issue. She didn't say we need to end anonymity, we need to have everybody have authentication on the internet. She just said it was a thorny issue because of the fact that we want anonymity for free speech reasons, but it also presents the problem that criminals can act anonymously. She was pilloried for this one sentence in a report. I mean, absolutely lambasted, largely by civil libertarians. And I thought, well, that if that's where we are, that you can't even recognize that anonymity presents some thorny issues to law enforcement in particular, we've got a major problem. And then, of course, you had industry that opposed any threat of government regulation vehemently. The tech industry worried that if cybersecurity was regulated by government, it would thwart innovation in technology. And the users of technology were worried that this would just impose costs on them because they would have to meet federal mandates that they otherwise wouldn't have to meet. So who was left, you know, talking about the need for some sort of regulation? It was the few people who actually had some responsibility for cybersecurity or national security and recognized that this was a problem. Because the things that Stuart talked about today, the vulnerability to nation-state attacks, they all existed 15 years ago. They existed almost 20 years ago, really. But there was not as much recognition back then. People who were involved in this field were called fear-mongers. You can look it up. There's less of that now. There's more recognition that we've got to do something, that talks of public-private partnerships, my least favorite term in the entire world. It's really just not enough, and it's not even a placebo because there's not even a pill you can take. It's really just a waste of breath. So at least we've made progress in that sense. So to me, the interesting thing is going to be to see whether the administration's proposal combined with Collins, Lieberman, actually moves forward and that we get something at the end of the legislative process that begins to move us forward.
Thanks. Your comment on the public-private partnership was telling, because we're almost going to call the symposium that, and you know, is it working? And I guess what I've discovered is that the problem with the public-private partnership is that the partners don't trust each other. I've heard the chief security officers of some of the biggest names on the Internet say things like, if they have a breach, they're more likely to call their competitors and troubleshoot it with them than they are to notify the government. They'd rather reveal their secrets, embarrassing secrets, to their competitors than to their government. But anyway, John, you're supposed to be the commentator on this.
Sure. Well, I agree with Michael that certainly these proposals show some progress in an area that has had virtually no serious legislation proposed out of a White House. So at least we now have something we can debate and sink our teeth into from a perspective of enhancing, I'm going to think of a different word that won't offend Michael, collaboration between the private sector and the federal government. Certainly one concern that companies have, several have been noted already, but one is, what will you do with the information we share with you, government, Will it come back to harm us in some way? Will you investigate us? Will this mean that we will have to make a disclosure to publicly to our investors that we would not otherwise have to do because we don't think it's material, but because we told you and you start telling other people, we feel like we need to get ahead of it. So one promising development, I think, in the legislation is a safe harbor of sorts for companies who voluntarily share cyber threat information with the Department of Homeland Security in order to get, in return, as long as it's for that purpose, to get immunity in terms of what that information could be used for. So it goes to the benefit of the government. And I agree also with Michael's other point about the overlap between the national security and the economic security aspects of this. One interesting analogy I'll put out for your consideration, we don't have time to develop it, but I first heard this, maybe others are talking about it too, from a Cornell University computer science professor, Fred Schneider. He said, look, the model we ought to be thinking about for cyberspace is public health. You can see how public health also has national security and economic aspects. That cybersecurity is not really rivalrous, because my cybersecurity is better doesn't help me defeat my competitors. To the contrary, if my cybersecurity is better in my company, it's going to be better in other companies too. If I'm catching threats, be less chance that you will be affected by them, given the way that cyber attacks work. And in public health, as in cybersecurity, what we really care about is getting the network running up again, right, as fast as we can. Less about retribution and punishment and financial recovery. So I'll offer that analogy for your consideration. I think it enforces Michael's point about economic and national security being really overlapping in this area.
Mark or Warren? Mark, what about the evolution of our thinking on privacy issues over the period of time that Michael described?
Yeah. Well, thank you. And, you know, it was interesting as people were talking, I thought to myself, well, let's see, new computer network technology, increasing vulnerability of U.S. business, threats from abroad, questions about the role of government, controversial proposals. Oh, yes, it's 1984. That's John Poindexter, and this is NSDD 145, which is when a lot of this debate began, because in fact it was back in the mid-1980s when the government first came to private firms and said, we're concerned about the vulnerability that Nexus has, for example, and foreign acquisition of sensitive information within the United States. We think the government has a role to play in promoting network security. The Congress took a different view. And, of course, in 1987, there was a decision made through the passage of the Computer Security Act to place primary responsibility for domestic computer security within the Department of Commerce and not at the National Security Agency. Now, we find ourselves 25 years later in almost the same place, except the agencies have changed a little bit. I mean, the NSA obviously still has a presence in the debate, but now it's the Department of Homeland Security, which is the civilian side, you know, of the U.S. government. And there is obviously some question about the role between these two agencies as to domestic security. Now, I make this point because sometimes when we talk about privacy rights and the concerns of privacy groups, people tend to think, well, this is largely about protection of data and wiretap laws. But I think that's really only a very small part of the discussion. I mean, obviously, we have an interest in the circumstances under which communications can be intercepted. You know, I was listening carefully this morning when Mr. Bradbury was talking about the use of consent to enable broader surveillance of networks within the United States. I'm very uncomfortable with that, but that's still just one part of the discussion. I would suggest, particularly in our panel this afternoon, that an equally important part of the discussion is the question of how do we ensure oversight and transparency of whatever government agency plays this role with respect to network security within the United States. So I guess I'm here to say that even though we have any number of lawsuits against the Department of Homeland Security, in fact, I think we began litigating against DHS under the Freedom of Information Act even before it became a formal agency. We had concerns when it was an office within the White House because decisions were being made, and we thought it was appropriate for the public to have access to the basis for some of those decisions, and the court concluded it was not, in fact, an agency for FOIA purposes. But even though we have this long tradition of sparring with the Department of Homeland Security from the privacy perspective, we nonetheless would rather have a public-facing agency with all of its flaws and criticisms, because at least there's an opportunity for assessment, debate, discussion. We operate under public law instead of executive order. Agency heads testify in open hearings as opposed to closed hearings. And as a consequence, I think we simply end up with more accountable and also, in our view, more effective government action. I actually, you know, agreed with a number of the points that Stuart Baker made during lunch. Not many, but a few. And I think one of the grave risks we run right now is accelerating our dependency on critical infrastructure. In other words, at the same time that we've identified this vulnerability and said, how are we going to protect it, we're simultaneously moving all of our key utilities and electrical services and other, you know, forms of energy into this network, making it that much more risky. And of course, the amount of personal data that's being collected and not adequately protected, I think, raises a similar risk to personal privacy. So in evaluating those decisions as well, I think we come down on the side of government decision-making that's more open, more transparent, and more likely to produce results that are ultimately effective. I make some other points here as well. You know, one of the related concerns about the NSA's role in this particular field is its impact on technical standard setting. Now, Stuart and I actually go way back. And one of the early issues we debated back in the 1990s, you know, was the encryption standard, or be a little bit more precise, the escrow encryption standard. And that was a question of whether it made sense to put in place a technical standard that would enable ready access to the content of encrypted communication. And the view on the government side, which I don't think was unreasonable, I think it was deeply flawed, but it was not unreasonable, was that if we allow people to get access to this form of hyper-privacy, this very robust kryptonite-style communication technology, then we will find ourselves frustrated when we need to execute lawful warrants and to stop bad guys from doing terrible things, which is, of course, a legitimate concern. But to actually act on that concern would require putting in place a very elaborate infrastructure that would make all communications subject to a type of intercept and vulnerability that wouldn't have otherwise occurred. Now, that came about in part because a large part of the NSA's mission, you know, apart from communication security on the one side, is signals intelligence on the other. And if you can get access to communications that might be useful, of course, in this realm, you want access to communications. And that led to a very aggressive effort to put in place a technical standard that I think we can now say would have actually left U.S. networks more vulnerable to attack. And this, you know, goes really to my final point about securing networks. And I think the difficult question, I'm not sure, frankly, what the issue is here. I don't think there's really any dispute that if we could develop a government role that would focus solely on malware, on executable code, and we had the government saying to people, we want to ensure that these techniques that might pose a threat to an employee, widely deployed, this is a form of intrusion detection, maybe it's intrusion prevention, the, you know, various iterations of Einstein, maybe there's not so much opposition in the civil liberties community. But I think the very real sense is that that line is increasingly hard to draw. It's not simply the executable code we imagine the government is interested in. The government is interested in, you know, who is participating in these communications, what are the contents of the communications, what are the frequencies of the communications, what is the network of the communications tell us about the structure of our adversaries who are coming toward our networks. And you see, once that door has been left open, then I think the risk of an open-ended surveillance authority is, you know, very real. So, you know, in summary, when we think about the privacy issue, there are a whole range of questions here. The question of who gets access to a particular communication, I think, in the end, is actually a very small part of the analysis.
Michael, can you comment on that?
Mark's comments bring to mind the late 90s when we were conducting investigations into hacks and viruses, and I would come under withering attack from civil libertarians for the way the FBI was conducting investigations. And I remember at one point thinking to myself, if only these guys knew, they would realize I'm their best friend, because at least what I do is transparent. What we in law enforcement do is relatively transparent. We're accountable under law. There's their oversight. Most of what we do ends up going into court as evidence, so our methods are transparent. If they knew what the NSA was up to, they would not be bashing me so hard. And I remember specifically, actually, in 1999, I was in a congressional hearing on the investigation into the Melissa virus. And most of you are probably too young to remember that virus. But it was one of the first viruses that affected a lot of people in this country, was pretty destructive, got a lot of attention. And it was one of the rare cases where law enforcement actually caught the guy who wrote the virus. So I was there in a hearing in the House, and Anthony Weiner starts questioning me. And he says, you know, the way the FBI conducts these investigations is very troubling to me, which I thought was odd because I hadn't even yet explained how the investigation. But he then went on, if you get the transcript, it goes on for about 20 pages. And of course, I'm saying very little. He's going on and on. And he's posing this hypothetical to me in which his computer gets infected by the virus. And somehow the virus causes his computer to send a love letter that he'd written to his girlfriend to another computer. And would I be able to read that love letter without getting a search warrant because it was on someone else's computer? I was shaking my head thinking, this is a United States congressman who's posing a hypothetical about a love letter to his girlfriend? This is just bizarre. And little did I know. If only back then, if it existed back then, the hypothetical would have been even more interesting. So, you know, at the end of the day, I very much agree with Mark that I'd rather have agencies that are public-facing and that have more transparency be principally responsible for cybersecurity and especially for dealing with those issues where there is inevitably going to be tension between privacy issues and free speech issues on the one hand and security. You know, the people who say in any administration or anybody outside of government that you can have both without making compromise, I think they're just being unrealistic. There are some things where you don't have to resolve the tension, but at the end of the day, if you're going to deal with this problem seriously, you do have to make some sacrifices. And I'd rather that be done in a public way, in a way where our elected representatives are making those decisions, not where some secret agency is doing it without any of our knowledge.
Any comments on that from other panelists? We'll circle back. So Warren, it is tour de horizon of the cyber field. Stuart addressed your subject on some level. Can you now in a more granular way speak about the administration's proposals to expand the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act?
I'd be happy to. I realized Stuart Baker started with a little bit of a rant on the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and I realized I found a topic in which I can out-rant Stuart Baker, which I consider a fairly significant accomplishment. So this is a law that started with a perfectly reasonable idea. Back in the 1980s, prosecutors were trying to prosecute computer hackers, and they couldn't really find a crime that fit the concept of sort of trespass into a computer, because criminal trespass laws require an actual human trespass, and traditional laws on theft require some property that is taken. And when somebody is breaking into a network and looking around, it's not obvious that there's any property that's taken, because nothing is really deprived from the victim of the offense. So Congress came up with the idea of a new criminal law based on unauthorized access to a protected computer, the concept being kind of a computer trespass crime. And all 50 states have now enacted the same basic law. About 30 or 40 foreign countries have done the same. And there's one small problem, which is no one knows what an unauthorized access is 30 years later, 25 years later, after these laws have been enacted. The core prohibition clearly applies to computer hackers, sort of what we think of as hackers. I mean, even that is just a buzzword. But someone who's breaching some sort of a code-based restriction, breaking into a system, using somebody else's password, getting in a way that the network is designed to block. And everybody agrees that that's an unauthorized access. The problem is that it's not clear about other kinds of access and whether they are authorized or unauthorized. So here are a couple examples. You're an employee, and your boss says, you can't access our network for reasons contrary to our interests. You can't access the network to visit Facebook. You can't access our network to do things unrelated to work. Let's say you do those things. You go to ESPN.com and check a sports score. Well, are you using the employer's network in an unauthorized way? Are you exceeding authorized access? Well, the employer owns the network and has said you can't do that, so in a sense you have, but it's pretty different from breaking into the network, right? The owner of the network has said, go ahead. It's just that they've imposed some conditions on when you're supposed to do it or not. So courts are currently struggling as to whether that is the same as hacking into a network, with a couple of courts saying, well, it sure seems to be unauthorized to us. You can even go further to cases where there's no written restriction at all, but rather it's just sort of understood that you're not supposed to do something on a network. And here there's actually currently a circuit split on whether it's an unauthorized access to a network for an employee to do something disloyal to the employer's interests on the employer's network, where there's no warning. It's just sort of understood that employees are not supposed to do things contrary to the interests of their employers with their network, sort of an agency principle that some courts have incorporated into this statute. So we have a law that clearly covers hackers, which everybody agrees is a good thing, but then might cover disloyal employees, might cover anyone who breaches a contract on the Internet, and there things get pretty uncertain. The how far things have gone would include the Lori Drew prosecution, and I will disclose I represented Drew in a pro bono capacity. This is an individual who was charged with violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for violating the terms of service of MySpace. She helped create a profile that included incorrect factual information in a MySpace profile. For those of you that don't remember MySpace, think of it as the Facebook of 2005. So it turns out that almost every MySpace profile also had factually inaccurate information. Everybody involved in the case that had a MySpace profile also had lied. The person who created MySpace, actually, had lied about his own age in his MySpace profile. So everybody who used MySpace was violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, according to the federal government's interpretation of the statute. In that particular case, the district court said, you can't construe the statute that broadly. It would render the statute void for vagueness. But the courts are still struggling as to what the limits are of that. A recent Ninth Circuit case concluded that if an employer imposes any restrictions on the employee, the computer's right, the employee's rights on the computer, then that controls the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and any violation of any employer restriction is an unauthorized access, which is a federal crime. Now, you might be thinking this is a federal statute. Surely it only applies to cases where there's some sort of federal interest. Well, that would be so 1995. It was once the case that the statute only applied to federal interest computers or required some sort of interstate nexus. It turns out Congress's interest, affinity towards federalism principles sort of comes and goes, and it's completely non-existent in the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act context. The statute has been broadened over time such that now the definition of a protected computer, the sort of special federal interest computer, means any computer that can be covered under federal commerce clause doctrine, both in the United States and outside the United States. Now think about how far that goes under the Gonzales versus Raich precedent, where Congress can consider all of the devices put together. In other words, they can ask, does every computer in the world, considered collectively, have an impact on interstate commerce? If so, they can all be regulated. Well, guess what? That means all computers in the world are covered under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, with one statutory exception: handheld portable calculators or similar devices are exempt from the definition. It's from 1986. The statute actually says all computers are covered except for typewriters, if you happen to have a typewriter, it's not a protected computer, or handheld portable calculators. So if you had your Texas Instrument calculator that you might have had in high school, that is not covered. Everything else with a microchip in the planet Earth is covered by the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and no one knows what the prohibition means. Could mean violating any contract. So what's the administration's response to dealing with the statute? Is anybody interested in clarifying what the statute actually means? No. The cybersecurity proposal includes an enhancement of violations under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, making the basic unauthorized access crime, which is unauthorized access to any computer anywhere on the planet, in which any information is obtained, which includes merely being observed, goes from being a misdemeanor to a felony. So it used to be that was just only could serve 1 year in prison for each violation of a contract or violation of a term of service online. Instead, it will be a 3-year maximum sentence, a felony. Now, you might think, what's the difference? You know, 1 year versus 3 years. On the whole, that's not a major shift. In practice, though, that's an incredibly important shift. And the reason is that prosecutors are not going to charge misdemeanors. Misdemeanors are, for a federal prosecutor to bring a misdemeanor is such, it's like bringing a BB gun to a battle scene. It's just, it's small bore. It's the judges get mad. They say, why are you wasting the resources of the federal government bringing misdemeanors? If you can make it a felony, on the other hand, prosecutors are going to be interested, and FBI agents are going to be interested. So what this proposal, what the administration's proposal, which is, you know, sort of just, let's clarify the penalties, that's what the section is called, clarification. Who doesn't like clarification? It's actually a considerable expansion of liability of a statute that no one understands, no one knows what it covers, but could pretty much cover everybody in this room. So it's, I think, a tremendously disturbing development in the law that it seems that Congress is more than happy to expand the statute, removing jurisdictional thresholds, adding penalties. Part of that is just Washington, right? So if there's a problem that needs solving, passing a criminal law is the way to solve it. And you know, that's how things work in Washington. If there's already a law, you either enact the same law again or you enhance penalties. Those are sort of the options that Congress seems to look at. In this case, that seems to be just repeated every 2 or 3 years. The law gets broader and broader, and yet, again, nobody seems to know what it covers. So to my mind, the answer is for Congress to stop expanding the statute that no one understands and to actually have a hearing and actually look at what is Congress interested in punishing, what's the kind of conduct that the statute is trying to address. Once Congress clarifies that, then I think it may make sense to add penalties in some areas and maybe cut them back in others. But until we know what the statute actually does, it's a terrible idea to just expand the scope of liability. The one benefit to this, at least to those of you that are worried from an actual terrorism standpoint, you know, cybersecurity and national security can have an important connection. From a national security standpoint, if unfortunately our nation is someday subject to another 9/11, one solution the government could have would be to set up a website called don'tvisitthiswebsite.com, and then send emails to any suspects, don't visit this website, but here's a link. And if anybody clicks on it, that would be a felony, and they could be arrested and put away for a long time. So it would be a sort of preventive detention measure harnessing the Computer Fraud Abuse Act. That's the only national security angle I can see to this, which doesn't strike me as a great idea. Again, it's just Congress is going in this direction and doesn't seem interested in stopping, and it has very little to do with national security and has a lot of difficult civil liberties problems along with it.
Or if you were to define, would you define a core offense under the Act? And if so, how would you do it?
Yeah, I think the way to do it is to say that breaching a code-based restriction, sort of bypassing a password gate or using somebody else's password, that's an unauthorized access. But that any sort of breaching a social norm, doing something you're not supposed to do, that is not covered by the statute. There has to be clarity. And there should be very, very specific context in which breaching some sort of a contract, some sort of agreement, can lead to liability. So I think it makes sense, for example, a government employee who's controlling a sensitive database that has a lot of private information, accessing that network for personal reasons, that should be an offense. But that same concept should not apply to every computer all around the world that does not have any sensitive information on it and is not being accessed only by government employees.
Mark, how does that sound to you?
Well, that might work, although I wanted to first say that I'm very happy to hear that there's a federal statute out there that Oren seems to like almost as much as the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. I know another one of his favorite well-crafted federal laws. Actually, about a dozen years ago, I think, over on the consumer privacy side, that I tried to use ECPA and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act to go after cookie-based advertising. Because it was very interesting to me that advertisers were beginning to exploit certain technical features in web browsers to place information on the end user's computer that the end user hadn't actually granted permission to. And under the statute, that seemed to exceed authorized access. But, you know, there were two problems. One is that there are typically thresholds, or there used to be in most of the sections of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, to establish $5,000 damages, which I think you could aggregate. But then there was also the one-party consent issue, because if you got, in effect, the website to consent to the placement of the ad, which is what they were effectively doing, the user was pretty much left out of the equation. Now, this is not an argument for further expansion, but I think what it does suggest is that when you do have a statute that's so broad, it just leaves a tremendous amount of discretion in terms of its scope and application. But I also remember from the mid-1980s when the bill was coming along, and we had raised some of these concerns at the time. And of course, you know, over this period of time, I think the expansion has simply continued. So.
Thank you. Now, this may be a bit repetitive for some of you, but I'd still like to do it anyway, going down the table, and not quite a lightning round, but maybe a rolling thunder round. The current bundle of the administration's cybersecurity proposals as they relate to private industry, what's the good part of it? What's the bad part of it? Starting with Oren.
I've certainly covered the bad part, all the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act sections. The rest of I think I'll pass on the good parts in part because they're complicated enough and I've only looked at them briefly, but I don't want to sort of incorrectly label the bad good. So I'll stick with my rant against the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act as my contribution.
Mark?
Well, on the good, I mean, I think this has been largely a public process. I think it's one that, you know, is generally transparent. I mean, we can look at the White House cybersecurity policy. We don't need to submit a FOIA for it and try to litigate to obtain it. So that's a step forward. Where we have concern from the user perspective, and maybe John and I will disagree on this one, is on the immunity provisions surrounding information sharing and cybersecurity. And I think what the government is trying to accomplish there is get the private sector to be more forthcoming about security vulnerabilities. The concern on the private sector side, of course, might be some liability if that trips over, you know, some of the wiretap statutes. So the deal that the government makes with the private sector says, okay, you give us this information and you're immune from that liability. But of course, the interest that's being traded, you know, in that particular scenario is oftentimes the interest responsibility action that the business has to safeguard its customer data, its client data. And we actually, you know, went through this a few years back. So we're going to watch that. I mean, it's not something I think from the user perspective we're so enthusiastic about.
John, anything that the discussion has triggered that you'd use to add to your remarks?
Yeah, Mark's right. We're going to disagree about this part. I think it is significant, and for the reasons Mark identified, for private companies to have some protection now, if this were to be enacted, that what we share with the Department of Homeland Security, at least, won't come back to bite us. There's a good deal of uncertainty around all the legal questions involving cybersecurity, not least here, and at least this provision would provide some assurance to companies that there's a safe space in which to disclose that there has been an infection, that it's going to likely infect and sicken other members of this community, and here's a way we can begin the healing for that those particular viruses or other malware. On the bad part, I think I'll pass and wait to see what Congress does with it. I think some of these provisions could be substantially changed through the legislative process.
Michael?
In terms of things industry will like, I think they will very much like the federal data breach notification rules that preempt state rules. I advise companies when they have breaches, and it is just absurd how a company has to look through the data that was breached, if it could even figure out what data was breached, figure out what states the people whose information was breached are from, and then examine all of those states' data breach notification laws to see how to go about complying with each one of them. Because while they're similar in many respects, they also differ in many respects in terms of what the notification has to say, the timing of it, whether regulators need to be notified, and whether regulators need to be notified before the individuals or after the individuals. So it just creates ridiculous compliance costs, which are great for lawyers, but not so great for companies. So that would be a positive thing. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, I don't know if the changes are going to make much difference to industry, but the fact that the statute is so broad and seemingly applies to just the violation of an employer's terms of service and an employee's agreement is actually useful, because an employee takes proprietary information, goes to a competitor, and uses it, which happens very often. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act actually has a private right of action, so the employer whose information was stolen can sue under the CFAA to try to get damages or at least get revenge against that rogue employee. So that's actually useful for employers. The stuff we've talked a bit about, the new DHS authority to regulate critical infrastructure's cybersecurity plans, is probably not going to be loved by those companies that would be regulated. But I don't think they're going to dislike it as much as you might think. I think a lot of companies are beginning to realize they need some help. And this, in some ways, provides a venue for federal help.
Yeah. On that point, it could have been worse. The ability to use independent third-party auditors, right, instead of the government regulating directly.
Yeah.
could have been much worse from the industry perspective.
Anything else from the panelists before we open it to the floor? Do we have questions from the floor? Again, please identify yourself.
Bill Ludwigson from TSA. What kind of an attack from whoever, what kind of boundaries are there, or even perhaps a duty of self-defense, particularly when it comes to international boundaries, to take active measures against whoever's perpetrating that attack, whether monitoring or stealing information or whatever else, or do they have to defer to the government? What kind of things can companies do in that regard?
An excellent question. I think we'll be talking about it for years. And we don't have years to solve this problem. Oren just told us why the immensely broad scope of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and in some ways it's not broad enough because it doesn't reach, you know, gangs of hackers in countries with whom we don't have extradition treaties or good relationships with. I agreed with most of what Oren said about it being overbroad here in the United States, but you know, even with that breadth, companies have a difficult time putting their hands on the real perpetrators, right? There was an article just in the last week about some 19-year-old in the Netherlands that got arrested, right, from the anonymous organization, if it can be called that. I'll call it a gang, right? At least that's a country we're on good terms with, right? So those we catch. How many more don't we catch who are just beyond our reach because they're not from friendly countries?
Kind of a spin on that, though, with the WikiLeaks disclosure. Some friends of WikiLeaks attacked some of the people who had cut off services in support of WikiLeaks, and some of those companies retaliated. Any comments on that, and either from the panel or from the audience? I think I know Paul's thought about this.
Retaliation by
by the companies, by the company, right?
What was the retaliation? I don't remember. I remember them being retaliated against by the WikiLeaks supporters, but I don't remember.
Reciprocal denial of service attacks.
Somebody took down the anonops.net center where the board, where they were sharing targeting information of PayPal and Amazon and MasterCard. Somebody took down their own ops center with a DNS attack. Who, unknown, presumably the people who benefited the most were Amazon and PayPal. Could have been the U.S. government, could have been dissident anonymites who didn't like what Anonymous was doing.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if it were the companies, because of the fact that, to go back to your question, there's not a lot of leeway that companies legally have to hack back, or that's one term for it, or engage in active defense is the other term, because what they'd likely be doing is violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act,
right,
by gaining unauthorized access or causing damage to a computer that's somehow connected to interstate commerce. So the issue was raised a lot, particularly in the Department of Defense, but upon examination, there's not a lot of leeway. I was on a National Academy of Sciences group last year that studied this in depth, and the conclusion was really no different from what the Justice Department has been saying for 15 or more years, that you can't do that. You've got to rely on the government whether you like it or not, because the government does have the authority to do things like that. And there was a recent action by DOJ and the FBI, which I thought was an inventive use of the laws, where they actually seized some of the controlling computers that controlled botnets that were helping to perpetrate distributed denial of service attacks, and they use forfeiture laws and the CFA and subpoenas and a variety of other instruments to actually seize those computers, to take them down, and to in part to send messages back to other computers to bring those down. But a company alone really doesn't have a lot of legal authority, so that's why I doubt it was Amazon or MasterCard or others doing this.
Other questions in the back? A little louder, please. A little louder.
I mean, I'm not sure if I fully understand your question. I will say that there's a very interesting debate taking place right now in the internet community about the deployment of DNSSEC, which is a way to deal with phishing attacks and other types of spoofing that lead people to believe that they're at a website, for example, that they're not actually at. Now, there's a range of opinion about DNSSEC. It's a technique of authentication or attribution. You can do it, you know, at the domain level. You can do it at the individual user level. If you feel strongly about anonymity, which actually I do, Michael, and I will point out that at the time that Attorney General Reno made the comment, the Supreme Court had four straight cases saying that anonymity was a part of the First Amendment. So it was a bit like saying, you know, the First Amendment raises thorny issues. That was kind of how we, well, yes, but
videos, child pornography.
Yes, I know, but I mean, there are, you know, a couple different ways you can go there. But the point I was trying to make was simply on this current debate on DNSSEC, there's going to be a range of opinion about what you're trying to accomplish. But I think that debate has to be an open and public one and reflect, as I say, a bit of democratic discourse, however it turns out. What concerns us, of course, about standard setting that's classified, that impacts, you know, on the civilian side, is that people simply don't know. I mean, they don't know what the basis of the decision is, what the consequence of the decision is, or how the device that they're relying on actually operates. And I think that's, for a variety of reasons, you know, not a place we would end up. So, you know, part of the preference in the Clipper days for non-escrow key encryption was about a better privacy technique, but it was also about the openness of the determination.
Sure, I'll ask a question. One of the provisions of the Obama administration's proposal would authorize greater sharing of information from private sector actors to the government. And providing safe harbors for a lot of what they do and preempt contrary state and federal laws. Two questions related to that proposal. One, for Mark, from your perspective, what are the privacy and security threats of that kind of sharing? And another one probably for John, which is that I think it was you who said that that private sector actors are much more likely to want to share information with their peers. It was Michael who said that. Then with the government, for a host of reasons, not the least of which is the interconnectedness of their own networks and that they share problems. Is there any concern on your part that by authorizing private to government sharing and providing a whole bunch of safe harbors and inducements. The proposal is either implicitly or explicitly trying to stamp out private to private network security information sharing that would advance network security without engaging the government. And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I mean, just briefly, I raised before the concern about the immunity provision from the user perspective, because in many circumstances, this is data concerning the customer or the client. The security breach issue was raised, and it's probably, as Michael said, true that most businesses will favor the White House recommendation on preemption for state law. Now, I've actually testified in two congressional committees over the last couple of weeks against preemption on the data breach front, in part because there's a real concern that there's going to be a very low federal standard, in part because it has been the experience of the states that even when they think they get it right the first time, they have to come back quickly and change their state laws because, for example, California suddenly realized, guess what, it's not just financial record systems that get breached, it's also medical record systems, or it's, you know, government agency record systems. And one of the things, if I can say, our federalist form of government allows is for the states as laboratories of democracy to try different legislative approaches, particularly when you have rapidly evolving problems. So, you know, again, I certainly understand why business would prefer a single national standard for breach notification, but it does go against, you know, a federalist form of government that can allow states to try different approaches.
As to your second question, yes, it's important for the industry to continue to do a lot of company-to-company information sharing about cyber threats. I don't view the legislative proposal by the White House to endanger that. I think it's a helpful thing for the government to create a safe space for companies to do this. I don't think that'll make companies less likely to do it with each other. I do think it's important that you know, we recognize that companies, like human beings, are inclined to share sensitive information only with other entities that they trust. Right? And so I think a piece of this problem, part of the solution, is going to be to facilitate trust mechanisms and to let this go organically as fast as companies learn to trust each other and to trust the government with these limited uses of information. It'll be hard to rush that process, and I think rushing it will cause a backlash in companies.
Well, I'd like to keep on the schedule, even though we started a few minutes late. I know we all have schedules to keep. Michael has a train to catch, for example. I want to especially thank this panel for its expertise and insight. I'd like to thank Paul Rosenzweig, who was really instrumental in this symposium. Like many things in Washington, it began over a drink at the Mayflower Hotel. And last of all, I'd like to thank all of you for sharing part of your day with us. I hope you'll find it was worth your time and attention. Thank you.